eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Today's guest is Malika Andrews. She's an NBA reporter who covers that league nationally. You have seen her certainly on ESPN. Television. She recently was believed to be the youngest television sideline reporter ever to work the Eastern Conference Finals. Malika's only 25, but her work is remarkable for sure. She works for ESPN.com. You may have seen her byline in the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times. She's really one of the people in the industry. One of the young people in the industry whose name and work you should know. And in this piece, we talk about what it's been like to cover the NBA inside the bubble for 4 months, the challenges of that, the joys of that. Malika was very, very honest and very transparent during a SportsCenter segment with Scott Van Pelt regarding the grand jury's results on Breonna Taylor. And so she talks about getting choked up on air. She is very, very honest about her background and her family life. She left home at 14 after flunking out of middle school, had an eating disorder, eventually went to a couple boarding schools, and came back, did not, I believe, go to college immediately, worked a year prior to then. And she's just she's got a pretty unique family and a unique background. I work with her sister, Kendra Andrews, at The Athletic, who's a phenomenal young talent. And so I think you're going to enjoy this. It's a woman who is just really honest about her place right now in the sports media. Malika Andrews coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right. As I said at the top, Malika Andrews is the guest. She is an NBA reporter. And she covers the league nationally. So you've seen her work a lot during the bubble across multiple ESPN platforms, primarily television for sure in the last couple of weeks. But you can read her stuff on ESPN.com. You probably hear her voice on ESPN Radio. She's got some well-known experience prior to ESPN as well, including working at the Chicago Tribune. And she was at the New York Times where she worked in the sports department. For full disclosure, her sister Kendra works with me at The Athletic, and her sister is awesome and a rising star at our place. And pleased to be joined by Malika Andrews. Malika, you're in the bubble. How are you at the moment?
I am in the bubble. I could use another cup of coffee, but other than that, I am doing just fine.
All right, let's get some, let's just sort of get a little bit of the chronology here because I think people will be interested. How long, wherever your home is, how long have you been away from home at this moment?
So my home is New York City, and I have been away from home. Today is day 96, Richard. So whatever that is in months or weeks, 96 days. So I'm going on my fourth month in the NBA bubble in Orlando.
So once you're there for this amount of time, does the heightened part of the medical part, is it still feel heightened? I'm sure you're still getting tested often, and I don't know if it's daily or every couple of days, but does that part at all go away, or are you always cognitively aware that you are in this sort of, for lack of a better word, medical experiment?
Well, so first of all, we are still tested daily here, and then we get those results generally within 12 to 18 hours via email. If you test negative, you would get a phone call if you tested positive, as it is with basically any scary doctor's office result, right? But I think that when I first got here, however many months ago, on June 29th, the biggest difference was all of the medical protocols that were in place then are in place now, but there's also just a layer of understanding what is functional for every day here, wearing masks, washing your hands, getting your daily COVID test, taking your temperature and pulse oximeter reading. That all happens every day. And what is more of a protocol that was put in place for the just in case, this is the strictest possible protocols we could have. And I think while the NBA is still keeping those in their back pocket, as time has gone on, a little bit of it has relaxed just in terms of, well, we've been living this way, we got used to it, and this is the functional adaptation of the rigid rules, if that makes sense. So for me personally, when I first got here, I was coming from New York. New York was a hotbed of coronavirus, especially New York City. And Governor Cuomo and de Blasio, the mayor, had really put in very strict rules. And Adam Silver and the league, when they were looking at the country and looking at where to host this at the time, Florida had an incredibly low case number when they decided on this. And then obviously we know that number went up basically just as the NBA was set to arrive in Orlando. And so when I first got here, I was coming from the mindset of having been bunkered down in my home in New York since mid-March. I was incredibly strict about it. I'm a little bit of a hypochondriac. So when I first came here, you're allowed to eat with other people and take off your mask. I wouldn't, because I was afraid. Now, 4 months later, I've come to understand that I feel more comfortable doing that as people have continued to test negative. But I get asked all the time, you know, by folks on Twitter, why are you wearing a mask on television in an empty arena? Well, two reasons. One, because it's a league rule that you have to wear a mask when you're in the arena if you're not a player or a coach or a ref, and even if it's empty. And secondly, because people say, well, you're tested every day. Why are you still wearing the mask? Because getting tested doesn't prevent you from getting coronavirus. And there are still folks who come into the bubble who've been exposed to a higher degree than I have, whether it's folks who go home at night who then come clean your room, whether it's folks who clean the arena at the end of the day. Wearing a mask prevents you or puts you at a lower risk of contracting it. Getting tested just confirms whether or not you have it. By that point, it's too late. So that's sort of how the rules have evolved a little bit.
Malika, at a very sort of base emotional level, have you enjoyed it? I get it. It's unlike any other experience, and you're covering history. But have you enjoyed it? Have you enjoyed being there?
You know, I have, but mostly for those reasons. Mostly because any time, and you know this, Richard, sports is so often thought of as the toy department in a newsroom. Anytime it carries gravity, anytime it intersects with other worldly, quote unquote, more important things, that's something I revel in. And that's what this has been, from the Wildcat strike from the Milwaukee Bucks to COVID protocols. That's what this is. So that part I've really enjoyed. I am looking forward to ordering in sushi from my favorite New York restaurants when I leave here.
What's been the toughest challenge?
Coming down here, I think, was scary because the risk you were assuming was very real. You know, there were liability waivers put in front of you. I would never liken it to Rukmini Kalamaki's work at the New York Times going into, you know, ISIS-controlled areas and putting your hands in backpacks that could contain some sort of explosives. But there was a risk involved. And that risk, especially watching the cases ebb and flow in Florida, was challenging. Covering the shooting of George Floyd was challenging. Being in here with Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying was challenging. Being in here kind of insulated while all of these things are going on in the quote-unquote real world, I think was a challenging dichotomy to balance. And then, you know, from a base level, the hours are really long. I mean, there's not that many people here. It's isolating. And you are here purely to work. And I love my job. I love reporting. But that doesn't mean that it's not draining when that is your entire existence every day, 7 days a week, more weeks than not.
I eventually want to get to your background, sort of how you got into the business, but I think sort of since we're talking about this, let's stay in real time here. Let's stay in terms of what you're doing now. Prior to joining ESPN, you were primarily a writer more than anything else. I think that's fair to say, even if you had some multimedia assignments. At ESPN, in a very, very short amount of time, Alika, you have become a prominent face on their television coverage and on properties, obviously, that are seen by a million people. I know ESPN put out that they believe you're the youngest television sideline reporter ever to work the Eastern Conference Finals. You were not a quote-unquote TV person prior to the last
no.
year. Right. So what has that process been like? But two, also, what has it been like to sort of just be more recognized and to know that your image and words are now being put out there to millions and millions of people?
I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about just how many people are. It's easier going on television and looking into a camera and delivering the news, not thinking about how many people are potentially watching. I think about being fair. I think about being accurate, but it would be much harder to deliver a speech or even the same stand-up in a theater or pavilion or somewhere where you could actually physically see the people that you are talking to, because like you said, it is a lot of people. In terms of the transition, though, I think that I was really lucky to have some really awesome producers that worked with me. Melinda Adams, who was here with me in the bubble, also actually worked with me in the Eastern Conference Finals last year. And at that point, I was doing sort of sporadic SportsCenter hits covering the Milwaukee Bucks. Her and Andrea Pelkey would take the time to tell me how my delivery could be better, how I could pace a little bit better, how maybe this information could go next time, and mostly how you're never as good or as bad as you think you are. And so to keep that in mind was helpful. But I think even more so than that, and I tell people this when, you know, college students ask me about television, like you said, I'm a writer. I'm a print reporter, and I love to write. I have loved to write since I was making up wild, crazy, fictional stories that I tried to pass off as fact in you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And I think that what I've learned is, if just like when I'm writing, the more information I have, the easier the story flows. I'm not driving a stick-shift car where when I stop, I stall out. I am able to kind of put together this story because I have so much information that it almost writes itself, you know, that kind of a what writes itself trope. And I think that if you spend the time on the information, yeah, there's variants of delivery. You might be excellent on TV. You might be mediocre on TV. And we have an entire range across our networks, but our facts, that's what really matters. So I've tried to invest the time on the reporting end so that just like when I'm writing, when I go on TV, it just sort of comes out. Because what's challenging is when you don't have the reporting to deliver. I think that you can massage delivery all you want, but that's not the most important thing. The important thing isn't exactly how you talk, exactly how you look, exactly that you get every verb perfectly correct. It's the story that you're telling, the information that you're giving, and that's where you need to invest your time. And I think that's the mistake that some folks make and that I've been lucky enough to have been guided on is invest in the reporting part. Don't worry so much about the delivery part. And I think the good information has what sort of helped me to continue to get these opportunities at ESPN.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
One of the things that when I've seen you on, when I've seen you on television, I think to myself, and when I knew you were going to come on today, is one of the questions I wanted to ask you about to just to get some insight from your perspective. You're 25 years old, which puts you literally in the age group, or even perhaps on the younger side of the players that you're reporting on. The league has a lot of 25-year-olds, 23-year-olds, 21-year-olds, obviously got 30-year-olds and 32-year-olds. But you're in one of these positions where you are of the generation of the people you are covering. Once upon a time, I was, Malika, but that ain't the case anymore.
I don't know, Richard, it's like... pass off as a 20-something.
That's very well read. That's well reading of the cue cards, Malika.
And that was presented by.
Yeah, sponsor that if you're going to do that. But the reason I ask that is I think like there's a real advantage. Sounds like such a weird word, but I think there's like a real commonality to being of that generation, and I think the athletes of that generation will trust you. You know, people might say, "Oh, well." You know, it's an old like trope, like, oh, black athlete is going to be more likely to talk to this black reporter. White athlete's going to be more talkly about white reporter, whatever. Maybe in some places, maybe yes, maybe no. But I do think there is total truth about having a reporter of someone's age and being able to relate to them on age more than anything else, passes gender, passes everything else. So just from your perspective in talking to these guys, both on and off the camera, how have you found your age to be a factor in your reporting and your access and everything else?
Well, I do think there's a level of relatability, right? I think that whether it's the same music, the same slang being similar in terms of maybe the things you would do in your downtime, although I don't really play a whole lot of video games, which I know a lot of the players my age do, a whole lot of video games. I don't play any video games, what I'm saying. But I do think just in terms of that, being able to relate and talk to someone who you are of a similar, when you're close in age, it just gives you that similar lens in a lot of ways on life, on what's kind of going on in the world. And that can be helpful. I think the line that has to be very clear is I do think that friendships can grow in businesses when you are spending a lot of time with people. I think especially the more you have in common with somebody, that can lend itself to friendship. And I think the only thing there is I have to be very clear that I am not friends of the people I cover. I think that you can grow to be fond of people. I think you can grow to enjoy people's company. I think that when I look at some of the greats in the business, my friends, my mentors like Jackie McMullen and Ramona Shelburne, they have become very close with some folks over a lot of time, and often a friendship doesn't develop until they're no longer covering them because, as I told a player this not that long ago, the issue comes when power needs to be held to account. And so I would never want to give off the impression of we're buddies, because if and when something goes wrong, if and when there is a fact that must come to light that you don't want to, I can't be your friend. And so I think that's just the line I have to walk sometimes, and all reporters have to walk with being similar to folks, whether that's age, that's gender, that's race, that's coming from the same hometown. I think that's the challenge inside of it. But I do think there's a lot of benefits just in terms of the fact that purely when I walk into a locker room, which I don't do anymore at the time of COVID, I look different. And so whether that's because I'm a woman, whether that's because I'm young, whether that's because I am Black, anything that's different can stand out. So when I ask a question, my voice might sound different, especially I've noticed in the bubble, there aren't that many female reporters here. The ones that are here are formidable. You know, I work with Rachel Nichols every day, but I think that difference can also be helpful because it's a different perspective. It's new. It's a different conversation than they've had with the 4, 5, 6 of my colleagues. And I think that sometimes that can be helpful. That's not to say it's better or worse, but it can be helpful.
I appreciate that answer. During a SportsCenter episode with Scott Van Pelt, he asked you about the Louisville police officers who shot Breonna Taylor, and the result of the sort of the grand jury result of that not being specifically held accountable for her death. And within that, here's what you said. I'll read it back to you. I know you know what you said, of course. I'm sorry that I'm getting choked up. A couple other things. And then I've prided myself in being able to be objective and cover these sorts of issues. But when it is so clear that the system of objectivity in journalism is so whitewashed and doesn't account for the fact that when I am walking up the hill with my wonderful producer, Melinda, reminds me that Breonna Taylor was 26 and I am 25, and that could have been me. It's very hard to continue to go to work. And that's what these players were feeling. It's a pretty extraordinary moment, in my opinion, on TV, because you did something that we don't often see, and that's really be vulnerable in real time on television and sort of open yourself up to the audience to something that's very, very raw. And I wonder, as you have a little bit of hindsight now, what do you remember about that moment today?
Well, I remember walking into that hit. I really had no intention of inserting myself in any way into my reporting. It's not generally something I'm comfortable with. It's not something I do really. And so when I walked in to do that hit, I really only had the intention of talking about Jaylen Brown and what he said, which was something to the effect of he was disappointed but not surprised, because this is something that happens over and over and over again, and it will continue to, Black people being shot by police and then not having those law enforcement officers be found guilty in the eyes of the law for murdering or hurting or killing that person, no matter, you know, with self-defense into consideration or not. And as I was delivering that, what hit me was that, as I said it, my voice just sort of cracked. And I, like I said, I didn't really have any intention of going there, but once my voice cracked, I felt the need to explain. And what I needed to explain was that before that game, I had been I had been, and I hope she doesn't mind me sharing this, Rachel Nichols and I had been crying in a back room of that arena and cleaned ourselves up as people walked by to go do our jobs, because over the last week, we'd seen this verdict, this decision by a grand jury in Louisville, who now one juror is saying that they don't feel they got all the information. We'd seen Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a champion of women, die, and to be surrounded by that was hard and human. And then to clean myself up, to go on television, to try to deliver this, what I meant by, and what I hope was the takeaway from folks when I said that about objectivity, is that when the system of objectivity was put together in journalism, those journalists that were writing objectively with this eye for an eye journalism were white men. And so it didn't account for the fact that your experiences are reflected in the really hard, challenging, difficult news that you cover. And my mentions were full of people saying, and I really do try not to look, full of people saying, well, you would never be in that situation because you are not fill in the blank. That's not the point. The point is that what we need to reckon with as journalists, and Wesley Lowery, my wonderful friend, wrote a great piece about this for the New York Times about objectivity and how it needs to change, is that it can no longer just be, it has to be emotionless eye for an eye, one Democrat perspective for one Republican perspective, one white perspective for one Black perspective, because that's not what objectivity is. And we know that, and we need to adapt to it. And in this time when truth is being challenged, we can't just say, well, this is what this person said, and this is what that person said. You decide what is true. There is a truth. It is our job to steer people towards that. And on that day, I couldn't remove myself. And the first thing I thought when I got off that, when the lights went off and I was done with that hit with SVP was, one, I'm a little embarrassed I cried. Two, I certainly hope players would not feel that I hijacked their message with my own emotions. And three, I certainly would not hope, I hope that Breonna Taylor's family wouldn't think that I was making something about myself when it is so clearly a personal tragedy for them. So that was a hard day. I didn't really go back, and I still haven't gone back and watched the full clip. But I do hope that as journalists, especially in sports, we continue to chew on that, on how we think about what is objective, because that is a privilege. Objectivity like that, the classic definition of it, and objectivity is something I hold dear. I think it's important to credibility, but my definition of objectivity is changing, and I hope others are too. So sorry for the rant.
No, not all right. I appreciate your sort of you giving some insight into how you think. What is your sort of two-part question here, but sort of the same part? What is your social media experience like? Sort of what I'm really asking, like, sort of what are your mentions like? And is it challenging for you to navigate and or self-censor on your social media feeds, understanding that your company has some social media guidelines, and understanding that we're in a very we're in a world where there are some people who steadfastly believe that we should all be siloed into what our profession is, and thus only speak about what our profession is.
I think that's silly. I think that, first off, in terms of my social media, Adrian Wojnarowski gave me some of the best advice. He showed me physically how to narrow down my social media feedback loop so that the notifications I get are only from people I follow. So I can only in my comments category see the people who I also follow. And that was very helpful. That doesn't mean that occasionally I don't look. I do. I try not to, because I don't think the human brain is meant to get feedback from that many people about who you are, how you dress, what you say. But I do think it is valuable to see how people are responding to certain stories. It can give you a little bit of insight into what tracks, what doesn't, even though we know social media is only really a fraction of how people actually read, especially our stories online, my written work. I think that's important. There's been a couple of times where readers have caught a typo in a story, and all of that I really appreciate is really valuable, and I'm thankful they take the time to do that. I do think there is a faction of Twitter, Instagram, other places that aren't productive at all, and so I try to weed that out because it's just not healthy, let alone happy. I do think we are moving towards a place where there's an understanding, especially in sports, that sports is so intertwined. It's really a microcosm of race, politics. These are people. People aren't one-dimensional. We overwhelmingly cover one dimension of who they are, basketball players, but that doesn't mean that's it. And I think one of the reasons I came to ESPN is the woman who hired me, Christina Daglis, has this just supremely awesome view of what sports are that jives with mine. And that is looking at where sports intersect with other things, whether that's fun, whether that's quirky, whether that's serious, whether that's political. She's not afraid to go there. And when I came to ESPN, that's what I wanted to work for her. I wanted to do that and tell those sorts of stories. And I think that while there are parts of ESPN that are meant for more sports highlights, there are other parts of ESPN that are meant for investigative journalism. There are other parts of ESPN that are meant for fun and silliness. There are other parts of ESPN that are specifically dedicated to the coverage of Black people or women. And that's because as a company, we're evolving. And just like any news outlet, it isn't perfect. We are continuing to sort of grapple with what our role is, especially now when everything's sort of been thrown into a blender. But I think that there is a larger understanding, especially in the NBA, that just the X's and O's of basketball, if a fan has watched the game, they know what happened. It is my job to uncover or deliver something else, something supplementary, something to enhance that. So I think that is helping to have a larger, even if that thing is on the court, I think that is helping folks to understand and move towards a broader definition of sport and sports coverage. And I like to give our readers are curious and smart, and we want to deliver intelligent and tickling and thought-provoking stories to them, and that's what our duty is. And so a lot of the time, those stories aren't just a recap of what already happened and they already know.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country. The kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
I want to finish up with this, Malik, and I realize this is a pretty personal topic. So, go as far as you want, or don't go anywhere if you don't want to. But, I told you this, as I say, as the kids like yourself say in real life, that I think there's value in talking about these things publicly, because people, it's just like when athletes talk about mental health. Like if someone well-known is going through something that you're going through, you can connect with them. There's massive value in DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love and Dak Prescott and all these people talking about mental health, because it's, I don't mean to proselytize, but I think if you're an adult in this real world, like that's what strength and leadership is. And so a couple weeks ago, you, in a very revealing piece with Andrew Marchand in the New York Post, told him that you had flunked out of middle school and that you had suffered from an eating disorder. And it was something that was a major part of your life. It obviously sort of still is. And I realize that that's a painful experience. But if you're comfortable, how dark were those times, and how did you come out of it?
They were very, they're really dark. I mean, I remember it was hard. It was hard for me. It was hard for my parents. And it was, I think that now I'm able to look at it as something that shaped me. I think that leaving home at 14, after you said I failed out of middle school, and was angry and struggling and closed off and engaging in some, I don't know, other scary behaviors. I do think having to figure that out became a big part of who I am and why I am. When I did that interview, my intentions are never to be the story or to be distracting from the work that I do, which is to cover other people's stories, to balance their stories with objective truths. And I don't want to be the story. But I also, when talking about someone who, when talking about myself, when talking about doing what I have done, I don't want to give people, when I was talking to Andrew Marchand, who did a great job, I didn't want to give this impression that I magically succeeded and everything was easy. And I also spend so much of my time convincing people to open up to me and that maybe they could help somebody else. And I felt like I needed to take my own advice. So yeah, to your original question, it was tough. It was something that I think now I can look back on and sort of replay the highlights like a movie, as opposed to feeling how kind of hopeless and sad and that I felt. But yeah, going from boarding school to another boarding school, feeling like I was letting people down, but not totally knowing why, feeling left out because I left at 14, came back at 18, and everyone who I was friends with, you know, folks talk about the friends they've had since lower school and middle school. I lost those friends. I alienated them. I was horrible to them. And I left, and life carried on without me. And reckoning with that as a, you know, I think probably normally narcissistic teenager, was hard. And to, you know, I came back, I graduated high school a year early because boarding school, it wasn't because I was some whiz, although I poured myself into school when I was away. It's because school was year round, because that was a structure that they could, you know, keep us in to protect us from ourselves. And even, you know, 4 years, I was there for on the longer end of both of my boarding school stints because I couldn't just get on this path and keep pushing. I had to continue to, I'd take two steps forward and I would just take a step back. And like you said, it's not something that's gone today. It's not something that I have a wonderful relationship with food and everything is perfect. There are still struggles that I have and I'm working on that. I think everybody is working on it. I'm thankful we're kind of in a place as a society where that's something that more people are digesting and feeling comfortable talking about. But I just, when I shared that with the post, my intention was to make sure that I wasn't giving off a false sense of perfection, because I think that's what I try to build sometimes. And in order to hold myself accountable in some ways, I didn't feel like I could do that. And I think more than anything, it was hard on my parents. It was hard on my sister who, you know, from 12 to 17 was 16 was without me. She was an only child for those years. Right. So, but it made me who I am. I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change it because I think it gave me my work ethic. It gave me a sense of independence. It gave me a drive to want to find purpose. I felt like I had none. So yeah.
I appreciate that. I have two more for you and then, I'll let you go back to covering the NBA finals. Your dad, Mike's a personal trainer. Your mom, Karen, is an art teacher. Your mom is Jewish and white. Your dad is black. And I think, as you told me prior to us coming on, doesn't necessarily classify himself as a certain religion. You are, you would classify yourself as African-American. You had a bat mitzvah. I mean, this is, I want to write about this family personally. It's because it's pretty great slice of America. I imagine your family has played a big role in shaping you. That's, as I read off all that stuff, you know, you're kind of a cool, like, you're kind of a cool mixture of a lot of different things. And I just wonder, you know, it's not really an open-ended question for you. It's just, it must have been an interesting family to grow up in. I would guess, given everything I just rolled off. And that's obviously just, you know, those are just like headlines as opposed to like knowing your folks and your sister, et cetera.
Yeah. No, I mean, it definitely was. I have a great family. I mean, you know, my sister, she is, I always say she's me, but kinder. but she's my best friend, and she is so much fun. And you asked me at the beginning of this what the hardest part is. I miss her a whole lot. I had so much fun when I was on the sidelines for the Nuggets games, kind of calling her to prepare for those broadcasts. And I also, you know, I'm older, and so oftentimes people refer to her as my little sister. You know, oh, you're Malika's sister. But when I'm around the Nuggets, I'm Kendra's sister, and I love being Kendra's sister. I love that sort of role reversal. Oh, you're Kendra's sister. Sometimes players they'd call her name over the Zoom, and a player would kind of look at me, and I'd shake my head, and they're like, oh, you're not Kendra, and would look back to the monitor because they were looking for her. They know her much more than they knew me coming into this. And so from the Nuggets. And so, I mean, she's great. I'm so proud of her. I think we both got we had hard work modeled for us. And that's not something my parents are, we're all incredibly close still. And, you know, I grew up having family dinners. Even though my dad worked late, we'd wait for him. And at the time I was annoyed as hell that I couldn't just eat before my dad got home. But I'm so glad that we did that now, because I have all these memories of sitting around our dining room table, because that's where we spent most of our time together, because both of my parents worked. But yeah, my mother has 4 siblings. My father doesn't have any siblings, and both of his parents are not around anymore, unfortunately. But my whole family, my mother's siblings, her siblings' children, my grandfather, Sandy, we're all really, really close. Like, Thanksgiving is not just 4 people, it's like 25. So they're great. I don't know what else to say.
No, that's awesome. All right. And the last one, for me is, you know, Malika, from the first time I ever talked to you, when, I asked you to do a panel, when you were in college, one of the college student panelists that I used on a Sports Illustrated panel.
Oh, yeah.
You always struck me as someone who, was not necessarily going to stay in sports for their career. And I always sort of thought like you would do it. And then ultimately, and that's not to say like if you did stay in sports your whole career, it wouldn't be awesome, but you just always struck me as someone who ultimately had other interests that you wanted to pursue. As you now are at ESPN at a phenomenal position that obviously, you know, so many people would want to be in, and covering like, you know, one of the great, obviously, pro sports leagues in the world. Do you think this is something that you're going to continue to do for the rest of your professional career, or do you have ultimately designs on doing other things?
You know, I honestly don't know. I love my job. I love the people I work with. They're more than my colleagues. They're my friends. And at the same time, there are days that I have, whether it's when there is an important Supreme Court ruling, or President Trump is diagnosed with coronavirus, or whatever the case may be, there is a killing of another Black person at the hands of police, that I feel that I should be reporting out those stories. And usually that feeling, I am able to feed, I'm able to help by covering the intersection of that thing and that event and sports. Whether it's when I was at the Times covering the wildfires through the prism of the equine industry, whether it was covering the Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels through the prism of the golf tournament they were at, whether that is covering coronavirus through the heartbreaking ways in which it has touched the NBA, like with Karl Anthony Towns and his mother, whether it is with the Minnesota Timberwolves or Steven Jackson attending or organizing rallies, usually that check that helps me feel like I am telling important stories that matter to people and their families. And it's so unfortunate that those stories are oftentimes tragedies. But a mentor of mine gave me some advice, and she said, the day that those feelings extend beyond hours or even days, but go to weeks, months, or maybe years, that's when you'll know that potentially it's time to look towards doing something a little bit different. And so I am not rushing to get out of sports. I love it. I want to keep doing it. And I honestly don't think I've given it everything I have to give. I have a lot more to give and uncover and learn and do here. But if there ever comes a point where I feel like, you know what, I feel like I've given this my all, I do have those other interests. And I would go explore them.
Malika Andrews is a reporter and writer for ESPN. You see her covering at the moment the NBA for multiple platforms, including ESPN Linear Television, ESPN.com, and ESPN Radio. Malika, I can't thank you enough for giving me time and for your honesty. And I have really great respect for you. You know, respect isn't about age, respect's about work. And I have such great respect for how you approach the craft. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast, and enjoy that sushi in a couple weeks. I'm sure it'll taste good.
Now that I'm counting down towards. Thank you for having me.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Malika Andrews for her time and her honesty. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I hope you did too. The Sports Media with Richard Deitch podcast, if you go to the archives, I think you'll find things that that you'll absolutely like. The episode prior to this, writing critically on Kobe Bryant, the guest was Jeff Perlman, the author of Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Laker Dynasty, as well as Donovan Bennett, my colleague at Sportsnet in Canada, on how he views the differences between the Canadian sports media and the American sports media, as well as American college football and some other things. Before that, we did a long segment on NFL viewership talk with John Orand, as well as authors Sayward Darby and Corey Sobel. Prior to that, Jim Trotter and Steve Weish of NFL Media, Kavitha Davidson and Jessica Luther. They are the authors of a what is still a relatively new book, Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back, Dilemmas of the Modern Fan. Steve Weish, Jim Trotter have a new podcast called Huddle and Flow. Before that, Renee Young, Renee Paquette, formerly known as Renee Young of the WWE. She was awesome to give me a lot of time on leaving the WWE. Head to the archives. A lot of the stuff, I think, if you're interested in sports media, it still stands up, and you can enjoy listening to some previous episodes. I say this for every podcast, but leaving a 5-star review and some kind of comment absolutely is critical for me. It is a niche podcast, and so that's how the podcast continues. I want to thank everybody, Cadence 13, Patrick Antonetti, Sean Cherry, John McDermott, Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.